I am Planta on the Line. This is the commentary.ca. There's a fascinating, thoughtful, and important book out now. It's called Lonely, Learning to Live with Solitude. One in four Canadians live with the affliction of loneliness. One can have a demanding job, good friends, and a family, but you can still feel incredibly lonely. That's what happened with the author, Emily White, who joins me now. She was a successful lawyer and yet had to deal with chronic loneliness. With this book, we see how insidious this is, what happened to Emily, and the work she's done to deal with loneliness and the prodigious research she's done. This is a necessary and enlightening book published by McClelland and Stewart. There's also a website, lonelythebook.com. From St. John's, Newfoundland this day, please welcome to the Planta on the Line program, Emily White. Good morning, Ms. White.
Good morning.
I think this is such a marvelous way to talk about the subject, and it's to go into your story.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great way to shine light on this condition. When you look back at what happened to you, when did it all begin?
It began for me really around 2001. Before that date, I had been in school for a long time, and I had been clerking at a big law firm in Toronto. So at school and during my clerkship, I was really surrounded by groups of people. I was part of a cohort. And after that ended, and after I began practicing law, I was single and living alone, and I noticed that without the easy sociability of school and articling and being at a big firm, that I was alone more and more of the time, and that the aloneness wasn't really ending. You know, I'm not talking about an evening alone. I'm talking about evening after evening after evening, and then weekends. And over time, my loneliness just began to build, and I didn't have the resources that I needed to keep it at bay. And I guess after about a year of that, I realized that what I was dealing with was long-term loneliness.
And when you look back at it all, because I'm sure there's a great introspection and investigation that goes on when you're dealing with something like this,
mm-hmm.
Could you have seen it early on? Like when you look back at your childhood, say, or,
yeah.
or years after that, I could have seen it there?
Yeah, definitely. I did a lot of research for this book, and one of the things that struck me in my research was this notion of a genetic predisposition, this idea that some people are simply born with a tendency to feel lonely more of the time and in a broader range of situations. And I am definitely one of those people. I mean, in my childhood, I was aware of feelings of loneliness. And people who I spoke to, I interviewed other lonely people for the book, and people who I spoke to talked about that as well. And I write in the book about my university years, which were actually extremely social. I'm talking about my undergrad years. Even in the midst of all that kind of crazy sociability that went on when I was an undergrad, there would be periods where I would feel this intense loneliness. And it wasn't chronic in those years because there were so many people in my life and I was so busy, but I was very much aware of the edges of something, of a state that, if I wasn't lucky enough in life, was going to settle. And it was like a premonition, which is a word I use in the book, and the state that I was alarmed about, and that I felt temporarily as a child and in my teens and in my early 20s, that really came and settled and manifested itself in a full way when I was in my 30s.
So how would it manifest itself? Like, what would a typical day be like?
A typical day in those years would have been me, I was living alone at a very nice apartment, I was earning a good salary, but me, you know, waking to an empty apartment, getting ready alone, taking the subway. I keep a diary. I always have, and it was one of the things that made it possible for me to write the book. And one day, with my diary, I sat down and I cataloged everything that I had done alone. And it was this long list, you know, waking alone, eating breakfast alone, deciding what to wear alone, And then, you know, a few hours of work, or not a few hours, but 7 or 8 hours of work, and then, you know, the list of tasks completed alone would just continue, you know, cook dinner alone, wash the dishes alone, go for a walk alone, read a book alone. And it became kind of exhausting to be doing all of that on my own and to not know how to end it or to not know when it would end. But, you know, if you ask about my days during those years, I was working at a small office, which was one of the problems I faced. I had left the big, I was in Toronto, so there, you know, there's these massive litigation firms, and I had left one of those firms for a very small office. And the office where I did work, people were often away. So although I was not isolated in the strict sense of the word, I wasn't housebound or anything like that. I felt sort of mentally isolated much of the time. And there often really wasn't anyone in the picture. You know, I wasn't isolated. I had a job, I had friends, but much of my time was being spent alone.
So when do you realize that that's a problem? I mean, I guess you realize it's a problem, but what do you do about it?
What did I do about
it?
I tried a lot of the things that you're supposed to try when you're feeling, when you're struggling with loneliness. I went out on internet dates, and I didn't have too much success with that. I know other people who have met with a great deal of success, but I did not meet with much success on internet dating. I attended one meetup group, but became so alarmed at the prospect of interacting. I describe this in the book, that I actually kind of snuck past the group of people that I was supposed to meet up with because the prospect of interacting was just overwhelming. I signed up for a long bike trip in Northern Ontario, thinking it might provide me with companionship or friends. And none of those things had the effect that I needed. One of the researchers who I speak to in the book talks about active socializing and about having to go out and pursue connections and make dates. And he says and this is Glenn Stocker at Brock University in Toronto, and he says what we're increasingly losing is passive socializing, where you just sort of hang out. You know, someone reads the paper, someone else cooks dinner, you might say something, you might not. And that was what I needed to fend off my loneliness. And what I was pursuing instead were these active socialization opportunities. And they were exhausting, and I wasn't very good at them. And ultimately, it meant that not only was I lonely, but I was spending a lot of time, and in the case of the bike trip, money, trying to, you know, fight off my loneliness in ways that weren't really working.
And if you do the things that people suggest you do, say go out and volunteer or go on the internet, and you're not successful at that, it's your fault, right?
Right, and I think it can leave you feeling a lot worse. One of the theories that I uncovered in researching the book, and which I think is 100% true based on my own experience, is that loneliness can make you withdraw, and it can leave you withdrawn and shy. And so what we tell people is get out there, you know, join, you know, and especially with the proliferation of internet groups like Meetup, you know, you're supposed to just join in. And what's not generally recognized, but which was true in my case, is that the loneliness itself can make it very hard to join in. So you're left, just as you suggested, feeling like a failure at your own social life, whereas in fact the loneliness is interfering in a way that's making it hard to socialize. And I think a lot of lonely people beat themselves up for not doing the volunteer work or not going on the internet dates or what have you, when in fact loneliness is having a pretty profound impact on the way they're viewing social relationships and the way they see the world.
So if we haven't read your book, now I've read the book, so I know what it's all about.
Yeah.
But someone listening to us and hears your story, they might think, because of whatever preconceived notions they might have, that you either suffer from anxiety or depression.
Yeah, and I think that's a fair question, and I think loneliness can correlate with those things.
Did you have those things?
I did not in particular. My anxiety began to increase the longer I was lonely, but I'm not a socially anxious person. And in the book, I talk about the fact that, you know, I was doing things that were not compatible with either depression or social anxiety when I was lonely, and that I started teaching part-time at a college. And I did do volunteer work at a soup kitchen in Toronto, and that I was doing things that a socially anxious or depressed person wouldn't do. You know, and when I was keeping a diary, I would say repeatedly, social anxiety wasn't really a concern for me because I knew that wasn't a problem in my life. But depression had been a problem in my life, and in writing about my loneliness in my diaries, I would always say, I'm not depressed. And I couldn't figure out what was going on. And what it was loneliness. You know, I think you can think of depression as global, as spanning out over your entire life. And loneliness as being really specific, loneliness being a distress about a lack of intimacy in your life. And that can correlate with depression, but it doesn't have to. Many of the people who I spoke to in the course of writing this book, you know, stressed that they were struggling with loneliness. Some of them had trouble with loneliness and depression, but many said, you know what, depression is not a problem in my life. It's loneliness.
And you found that you could, say if you were at home alone watching TV, you could laugh alone?
Laugh alone?
Yeah, like just say you saw something funny on the TV, could you laugh alone?
That's an interesting question. I could.
Yeah.
It wasn't constant demoralization.
Yeah.
You know, and there were pleasures that I took in the course of an ordinary day. I lived on the edge of a ravine, and I liked observing nature, for lack of a better word. And, you know, it wasn't the constant despair of depression that would make even the ravine seem uninviting. It was a sadness that lifted when I managed to connect with people, and that's something that's pretty different from depression.
I mentioned off the top that you did a lot of research for this book, a lot of research even before you thought of a book or started a book.
Yeah.
What you encountered there, do you find anything that surprised you?
I was surprised really by how much there was. I know that's not exactly what you're asking, but I was a pretty well-educated, you know, 33-year-old when I started this book. And I knew a lot about depression, and I'd read about social anxiety, and I'd read about all sorts of things. I'd always been interested in psychological issues. And I had never heard about loneliness research. Like, it was as though it didn't exist. And I was really amazed when I went to the library at the University of Toronto and saw that there were books out there. These were, a few popular books have come out since, but this was back in 2003. And so there were no popular books. It was all research-heavy, like data-heavy books. And I was amazed that they were out there. And then I started getting into the literature online and in the psychological and scientific databases. And there was just this wealth of material, you know, people studying loneliness. And I thought, my God, I didn't even know you could study that. And that was one of the things that led me to write the book, was to draw attention to the fact that this research is out there. I mean, some of it is increasingly sophisticated, like the genetics research. And I don't think we really have a sense of that culturally. We think of loneliness as something that's too vague to study. But in fact, for the past 40 years, people have been studying it, and there's a lot of information available.
And you mentioned earlier this genetic disposition
mm-hmm.
to it, and has there been research towards that?
Yeah, there has been research, and it's ongoing research being undertaken mostly in the Netherlands, but with collaboration from American researchers, and that's a really interesting kind of train of thought. People noticed that loneliness, I mean, this was, you know, 25, 30 years ago, was the first time someone said, you know what, loneliness tends to reproduce itself. They were looking at lonely mothers and lonely daughters and said this is being passed down from generation to generation. And the author of that paper, who's Daniel Perlman, who was then at the University of British Columbia, said it could be child-rearing practices, but it could be genetics. And I think what they have found recently, you know, fast forward 25 years, is that it is largely genetics. And when I talked to lonely people, when I was interviewing them for the book, many, as soon as I said, you know, do you think there's a genetic component to this, they were like, 100%, you know, and they would name a lonely first-degree relative. And I think that's an interesting way of thinking about loneliness because it takes some of the emphasis off of you, and you can start to see it as something that you might have inherited and that you, not that you don't have control over it, but it's, you know, it's not, it doesn't originate 100% with you. It's something that's been passed down.
And spotting it in yourself and in others. What's perhaps key to that, or what's noticeable perhaps in noticing that one has it or one's struggling with it?
I think just being aware of it. We tend not to hear a lot about loneliness. And many people who have contacted me through my blog have said, you know what, I didn't understand what it was I was struggling with, but now I do. Like, now I get it. I think a larger discussion about loneliness will allow more people to self-identify as lonely, to recognize the state being active in their own lives. And I think that's important. I think you kind of have to recognize, many people who contacted me have said, you know, I wasn't depressed. But other people have contacted me and said, I thought I was depressed, but you know what? I don't think I am. I think the problem is loneliness. And I think it's almost a vocabulary issue. You know, you need to know what word to use to capture what it is that you're going through. And when I realized that my problem was loneliness, that was helpful in a way because it let me focus on what the real problem was. And I did that through embarking on this major research project. But, you know, for other people, it could mean reading a book or talking to a therapist about it or, you know, doing something fairly non-demanding like attending a yoga class. But I think you need to name it as, like, step one before you do anything else.
And for you, therapy, did that help a great deal?
What I got from therapy, and this is going to vary hugely from person to person,
right,
is the freedom, and again, this is several years back now, the freedom to talk about it. I think loneliness is really stigmatized in our culture, and that stigma didn't extend to my therapist's consulting room. I felt able to say, I'm lonely or I'm struggling with loneliness, and that's a really hard thing to say. Well, I guess I just said it, but it's a really hard thing to say in the course of ordinary life. And my therapist didn't fix my loneliness, and I would beware of, there are therapists, especially on the internet, you know, who say that they will solve your loneliness for you. I certainly haven't called every single one of them, but I seriously doubt that anyone can fix your loneliness. But what my therapist, what therapy did for me was allow me to start talking about loneliness, and that was a really crucial first step towards writing the book.
You talk in the book about the spasm of dumb luck and how you found Danielle.
Yes.
Was that key perhaps to dealing with this as well?
To dealing with the loneliness?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a long process. It wasn't... I think we've got this idea that, you know, you meet someone and the loneliness just disappears. And that's true to an extent.
Yeah.
But for me, it was I had been lonely for so long that it wasn't the case of simply waking up one day and being a non-lonely person. You know, there's a researcher named Robert Weiss, who I interview in the book, and he says, there's a self that's associated with loneliness and a self that's associated with being in a partnership or being part of a close community of friends. And it takes some time to travel from one self to the other. You know, loneliness can really affect you, and I don't think you get over its effects simply by going on a first date with someone. I found for me there were issues that I had to work on over the course of months in order to really overcome the loneliness that had been bothering me since my early 30s.
You know, you're with someone now, so one thinks that you're perhaps cured. You're not, right?
I wouldn't use the word cured. A phrase that an interviewer actually used in reference to my loneliness that I thought really summed it up was daily maintenance. And I like that notion. I like the idea of having to keep your loneliness in mind and tend to it in a daily way. You know, I'm now living way out on the East Coast, and I'm quite far from friends and family, so loneliness continues to present itself in my life, even though I am living with someone now. And when I heard the words daily maintenance, I thought, that's it, exactly. I mean, I have to work at it in order to keep it from becoming a problem in my life once again.
How did you end up in the Arctic?
Oh, how did I end up in the Arctic?
Yeah.
It's kind of complicated, but if you're an articling student in Ontario, and I think this has changed since, this was 10 years ago, you can shift a portion of your articles out of your firm. So I shifted a portion of my articles to Nunavut, which took an awful lot of planning, but I did it. And it was great. It was really amazing up there. And I was up there in the summer, so the sun wasn't setting.
Yeah. So did that perhaps on this journey of finding out finding out about the loneliness and dealing with it, did that help at all? I mean, it is pretty isolating, isn't it?
It is. The interesting thing, and again, this has changed. I was in Nunavut in 2000, and I think the population of Nunavut has changed quite a lot since then. But when I was up there, a lot of people, because of housing, would come up alone. Most people did not come up with partners or families. So it was really common to lack close ties in Nunavut, though I made friends, and of course other people made friends as well. And that sort of aloneness that I experienced in Nunavut, where I would be hiking the tundra with my roommate's dog every night, I was alone, but I didn't feel as isolated as I did when I came back to Toronto and was suddenly in a great big city again, and felt enormously lonely. I think a lot of people idealize the North, but there's something sort of idyllic about it in some ways. And one of the things that's nice about it is this sort of notion that we're all really, really closely connected and we're all part of big groups. That doesn't sort of translate up there since so many people are on their own. But again, I can't comment on Nunavut now because I think it's changed a lot.
I was just thinking, there are people that I know that, mm-hmm. that are relatively solitary and that enjoy that.
Yeah.
Is that normal?
I think that's perfectly normal. You know, one of the books I talk about in my book is the fiction, the novel, called Hotel du Lac by Anita Bruckner, and it's about someone who loves being alone and who loves living alone. And I certainly wouldn't pathologize the enjoyment of solitude, and some people really do prefer to live alone, and there's absolutely nothing at all wrong with that. It becomes a problem when you're not okay with it. When you know, if you've chosen your solitude, it can be wonderful. If you haven't chosen it, it can be something quite different, and that's when it really starts to tip into loneliness. But I would certainly not go so far as to say that there's anything wrong with being happy on your own.
The reaction to the book has been quite positive, hasn't it?
It has been positive, and the nice thing about it is hearing from people through my blog saying that the book has made a difference to them, and that's really reaffirming.
You've done a marvelous service, Emily, with the book. It's just, I mean, I'd say it's a great book to read. Sometimes it's not, but that's because it's not because it's not well written. It's just because it's sometimes harrowing to read some parts of it. But congratulations on it. Continued good luck with it.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. The book is called Lonely, Learning to Live with Solitude. It's published by McClelland and Stewart. The website is lonelythebook.com. On the line from St. John's is Emily White, its author, in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.